listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, in our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone, we take a look at the end of the Soviet Union and points beyond. Luciana, we have an interesting topic to cover today. This is the essentially the destruction of the Soviet economy under Gorbachev primarily, and removal of the Communist Party as the primary political player. They're the exclusive role of the Communist Party being surrendered. And then the entire apparatus essentially being handed over to Boris Yeltsin in a strange Marxian exercise, Gorbachev having destroyed the state and the party, himself withered away.
Yes, indeed.
And then we go to shock
Very
therapy.
Good.
And we go to shock therapy, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. The withering away of the state, but not in a good way.
Right.
So that's exactly right. I think it had been George Kennan or somebody in the... I'm pretty sure it was George Kennan, who said that if you destroy the Communist Party of Russia, of the Soviet Union, then you could destroy everything else. So Gorbachev did that. I mean, there was a kind of campaign in the 1980s, in which communism was sort of on the accusing block, and so was Lenin. And there was an ideological weakening before. A campaign for an ideological weakening. In other words, weakening of the ideology that had been the source of pride the ideology that had instilled pride, courage, looking forward for ever since 1917 in Russians. There was a disorientation of the ideology in which the Soviet Union had lived. And then, through these subtle attacks and rehabilitation of people that had been traitors and condemned during the Moscow trials, particularly Bukharin, so there was this destabilization of the ideological mind in the Soviet Union with Gorbachev, and then came as the attack on the very institution of the Communist Party, and then once that was gone, as you said, it was easy to change, to kill the socialist economy. I'm trying to remember something that's important, Gorbachev eliminated central planning. So not only did he deinstitutionalize the state, attack the ideology, attack the institution, but also the economic base of the structure of the economic structure of the Soviet Union, of the social economic structure of the Soviet Union. So all pieces were in place for what followed, which in 1996, mid-90s, but especially 1996, resulted in economic shock therapy. That is the ideology of the West, of Milton Friedman, free to choose, privatization, no restraint by the state on the market, on trade, etc. So economic shock therapy came under the Yeltsin second, in full, under Yeltsin's second mandate, which was engineered and rigged by the United States, his second election, and it's not a secret, it's all over the place. So it was a coup. Yeltsin's 1996 election was a coup. So what I call the neoliberal Great Terror, to contrast it with what in the West is called Stalin's Great Terror, the neoliberal Great Terror came to the Soviet Union. It is known as shock therapy. So between 1992 and 2000, there were between 5 and 6 million surplus deaths. 170,000 people were victims of murder or murdered. The GDP fell by 50%. And this was a higher drop than during the German occupation of the parts of the Soviet Union that Germany occupied. 70 million fell into poverty. Death rates increased by 60%, sort of like countries at war. Life expectancy decreased in males to age 57. Abortions increased spectacularly, birth rates fell, there were suicides, the resurgence of illnesses that had been eradicated, like measles and diphtheria and tuberculosis. Some analysts have said that in Russia, under shock therapy reforms, Russia became the site of an economic genocide. Yeltsin's Russia was a disaster. He plundered Russian assets and gave rise to a new class of oligarchs. But Washington considered Yeltsin a Democrat and this plunder a progress. So Russia sank in an economic depression. into poverty, starvation, unemployment, social insecurity, and finally defaulted on the debt to bloodsuckers like the IMF and the European banks, etc., in 1999, which is 1 year before Putin assumed the presidency again. But this human disaster is never acknowledged in the United States. They simply ignore it. And yet this was the kind of Russia for which the United States rigged the 1996 elections to keep Yeltsin in power. Did you want to comment on this?
No, this is good history. Let's take this in first. People need this.
Okay, so now we know that that the U.S., the West, interfered and changed the economy of the Soviet Union with help from inside. For example, to give one example, Yeltsin's acting prime minister was a guy named Yegor Gaidar. And he was the architect of the shock therapy. He was a young economist. He wrote for Pravda. He was a Communist Party member and supposedly an intellectual. But he obviously had converted to Milton Friedman's free to choose economics. And he was a turncoat, basically. Yep. And there were many of these. Now, the question is, going back to 1956 and Khrushchev's demonization of Stalin by accusing Stalin of having cultivated a cult of personality, I think that we have said that Khrushchev began this opening partially because he started decentralizing power, giving sort of unexamined autonomies to local agricultural, for example, consortia, etc. But Khrushchev began this path toward we no longer have a class war. The result of that is that a class of oligarchs were actually waiting in the shadow to prowl and to rob the assets of the people. When he said we are a nation of people, there is no more class differences, and then he said there is no more conflict really with the West, we can get along. This was all contrary to reality, because right. at the same time, the Western countries, France, for example, was putting down both the Indochina anti-colonial struggle and was beginning to put down the Algerian anti-colonial struggle. That's just talking about France.
Right.
And soon, at the same time, as soon as France lost Indochina in 1954, the United States stepped in and it began the path toward the Vietnam War. So imperialism was well alive, not to mention that in Western Europe, NATO was formed. This was under Khrushchev's eyes.
Well, not only that, and also, I mean, almost simultaneously, it was within a year of the Indochina thing for France, the Bandung Conference, which was the opening shot in the uprising by the colonies against the colonialism. And so to say that the class war was over as some of the first shots were being fired, it was absurd, obviously.
That's right. It was absurd, but it was very convenient to the class.
That's correct.
That Khrushchev was actually supporting the petty bourgeoisie, essentially. And supporting, and that would grow in strength, thrive in the shadow, become the second economy, unregulated, Goss plan, the central planning was weakened, further under Brezhnev. And so we have this path toward a loss of ideological, what would you call it, ideological education? Ideological education. And then another irony under Khrushchev opening, sort of an early glasnost, was that Soviet citizens who were enjoying all sorts of social service advantages, you know, full employment, etc., education, health, because of the influx of goods from the West, importing goods and stuff, and seeing the stuff that was going on in the West, they began to compare themselves, their status, to the Western style, and forgot that they were an alternative. They had, socialism was an alternative to that. They were, you know, to that way of life, to capitalism, and began and began to yearn for things that they didn't have.
You know, so, you had some real weapons that were brought to bear here. I'm gonna sort of just move into Khrushchev's term and come forward a little bit and set a couple of things in motion, or describe a couple of things that were in motion. No, it's all right. One thing is that even though the ruble was fixed and there were several adjustments of it, three or four close to the revolution, and then one that lasted from the early 30s until the post-war period, and another from the post-war, like 47 or something, up until the early mid-60s, you know, revaluations and revaluations of it. But it was pegged to gold. And the Soviet Union actually had gold reserves that it was pegged to. But the West refused to allow trade in rubles with the they wouldn't take rubles in Western banks. So the Soviet Union, which of course had its economy first built up from, you know, from scratch, from feudalism, between while at war from 1917 to 1924, and then rapidly trying to stay ahead of the coming war from the mid-late 20s until the war, then had its economy destroyed again, then found itself encircled with a bunch of destroyed countries as buffers and also as clients whose people were expecting goods and services, built a rather impressive economy in short order that included an economy that could support the first space travel. all of that was going on, and the currency was not acceptable. And what that meant was whatever they did not make inside that economy, there was no way for people to obtain it from the outside. If you won't take my money, I can't buy your stuff. That's what that was about. Now, people didn't, the economy was organized differently, and partly because of the exigencies of the previous history, but there were also some public policy decisions that were made that actually are pretty forward-looking. People, when I was there in 1990 in Moscow, complained that they couldn't afford a car. They had fantastic mass transit, however. I was like, what do you want a car for? So, you know, anyone who lives in New York City that has a car, you know, they look at it as an albatross. You know, it's oh my God, I have to find a place to park this thing.
I didn't know how to drive until I came out here in the country. Right. In New York, I didn't need to drive.
Why would you? It was a burden. You know, a lot of things like that were not, you know, part of the economy. And so If you wanted to buy a car from the United States or Japan or Germany or whatever, and you're an average citizen, you couldn't buy it. Or if they didn't make electronic tape recorders to your specifications or some other consumer goods, because they couldn't make everything because there's only one country and a couple of neighboring pals. But they were doing pretty damn well. So what happened in 1964 was the creation of these thing called Berioska stores. They were like an alternative. And if you had... At Berioska store, you could... if you had hard currency, you could go in and buy like a Japanese tape recorder or camera or American jeans. That was a big item. Different things that you couldn't buy, that weren't made locally. Some of the things were made locally, but, they made pants, for example, in the Soviet Union, obviously, or there'd be a lot more people there. They didn't make Levi's blue jeans. Well, some places did, actually, or, bootleg. But so if you wanted those, and then you had like a, counterculture, quote-unquote, that was, pimping for a lot of these designers and everything else like they were doing here. So you had kids, I must have Levi's jeans, how that fashion thing works. They'd have to go figure out where to get some hard currency. Well, the tourists have hard currency that come to the Soviet Union. So what started happening was people started taking whatever they could put their hands on and selling it to tourists so they could buy stuff in the Berioska stores. Meanwhile, as this phenomenon was developing, the governments of first Khrushchev, then Brezhnev, and a few others, they start expanding the Berioska stores. So what starts happening? Well, I'm the guy that delivers the tomatoes from the farm outside Moscow to the market in downtown Moscow. Twice a week, the tomatoes fall off the truck, and somehow they end up in the hands of this guy who's behind the in-tourist hotel saying, "Hey, tomatoes." And he sells them for dollars or marks or pounds or crowns or whatever, Western currencies. They split that up between them, and then they go to Berioska store and buy blue jeans or whatever it was that they were after that they couldn't find in their own stores. What started happening was the shelves of the stores in the Soviet Union started to thin out because all of the goods were being diverted by a class of thieves, basically, that were being promoted, that both organized by the West... And, through the, the intelligence agencies and business people, because people making money on it. I mean, we know the story of the CIA and cocaine sales, for example, or weapons trading. They're business people for sure. And he hollowed out the economy. And what happens when you hollow out the economy is you lose the support of the public. People are going to work. They're growing the tomatoes. How come there's no tomatoes in the store? I worked on the farm all summer. What the hell is that? And as that happens, you've got a guy who's the same guy's by the time you're with Gorbachev, riding the top of the political apparatus and starts loosening the power of the Communist Party, which is where the only remedy to that situation could potentially lie. And so now you end up at this situation where the state collapses, the economy is in shambles, people that haven't stolen everything yet are stealing what's left. And then they bring in the consultants from the West to tell them what to do. And you get a guy like Gaidar and a drunk like Yeltsin to front for him. And then that's what we had. That's where we are now.
Yeah. Precisely. And there are many other things.
It was very complex.
That unraveled with interference and collaboration. Gorbachev, by the way, comes from on the edge of the North Caucasus. That's where this kind of second economy developed in the mafias. Right. He comes from Stavropoulos, right? Stavropoulos?
I don't remember where he comes from. Yeah.
And he comes from, petty bourgeois agrarian background.
Yeah,
exactly. so, but in addition to the primary goal, destroy the Communist Party, weaken the ideology, and then destroy the party, then bring in market economies, and then what Yeltsin was a white Russian nationalist. That is, oh, look here. We spend all this money on these stupid states like Poland and in the East and these, Asiatic republics. All our money, all our stuff goes there. So we need to become Russia again. We need. So it was a kind of, Russian nationalism.
Right.
That in a reactionary sort of way, because
yes.
What had to be done during the Soviet years was to actually control Russian nationalism, because it was
right.
50% of the population, 50% of the 90% of the expertise, and this was all lent out to the socialist republics.
Right.
Money, industrialization, advisors, engineers, Russian, etc.
Right.
And then the West accuses Russia of being an empire.
The empire.
When in fact the center, if you want to call it Russia, the center, was bleeding, and it's a negative term, but was in infusing capital in its periphery.
That's
in its
correct.
Outer.
It was the opposite. The flow, if
it
you
was,
were looking
yeah.
at the economic flows, it was the opposite of what happens in a colonial or an imperialist
exactly.
Situation.
And that, ironically, was exploited by Yeltsin,
yep.
which, you know, this way it gave way to the breakaway of the republics
yep.
that had themselves, it's so ironic, themselves
yep.
cultivated a elite class that was for selfish reasons
yep.
nationalist.
Yep.
And it just incredible. So but the U.S. helped in this, and I want to recount if we have a minute.
Yeah, we have a couple of minutes. I just wanted one extra piece of history here. In 1990. Yeltsin was elected to the Congress of People's Deputies of Russia, of the Russian Federal Republic. In May 29th of 1990, which is the first day I arrived in the Soviet Union by coincidence, he was elected chair of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet of the RSFSR, of Russia, in essence. And what ended up happening was there was a power struggle between the people in the RSFSR and the parallel mm-hmm. structures of the Soviet Union. And so these power-hungry nationalists, the power-hungry guys in the RSFSR, including Yeltsin, pitched nationalism, what you just described, basically, to the public. And that was how they got a little bit of... They didn't have public support for withdrawing from the Soviet Union, but that was their cover, was stoking exactly that.
That's right. The referendum of the spring of 1991,
right.
The people voted, with the exception of a few republics, until I think the Baltics
right.
and some others, they all voted to keep the Soviet Union, but then in December, in secret and illegally, without permission from the supposed parliament, the Soviet Union was dissolved, and I think we're rushing. But maybe if we only have 1 minute, well, I want to pick up on how the U.S. interfered with Russian relations with the former Soviet republics, particularly in the North Caucasus.
Yeah.
And
maybe that would be a good place to pick up next
yeah.
week, because we've got about a minute left. And just so people are aware of it, if you go to Wikipedia and type in Soviet Union referendum 1991, you can see
yeah.
by each republic, and even the constituents of the republic, like the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic is actually a federation itself, as the name implies, and is like a dozen republics inside of that. You can see how each one of them voted for and against, and the majority of it was, you know, huge in favor of remaining inside the Soviet Union. 90%, 97.6%, if you look at the at some of them, and overall, it was massively in favor.
Isn't that interesting? In the Asia part, beyond the Urals, it was 90%.
Yep.
And yet, the ruling elite in Tajikistan and in Uzbekistan, and they were the ones who were the nationalists. The people weren't.
Right.
And by the way, people in Ukraine approved staying in the Soviet Union by 80%.
That's right. And the republics, the three Baltics, their locals refused to participate. So people organized it themselves, and the results there were actually 95% in favor of staying in. And they said that the turnout was about 50%. So still, it seems like the majority of people there wanted to stay in. And so regardless of that, the nation state was disassembled. The economy was parceled out to a group of thieves. The people suffered.
About
100 of them. And of course, the real thieves who were here, you know, here in the United States, looking to get the oil and gas and everything else that lies under the ground there, and the real estate, and pull these people out of the market as competitors, etc. Once all of that was accomplished, you now have Yeltsin presiding over what's left. And out of the ashes of that comes Putin. And so we'll pick up, I guess, at the beginning of the administration of Yeltsin next week, and we'll take it as far through that as we can. Luciana, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure having this discussion today.
Thank you so much. My pleasure, too.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to World Apart. Cuba is one of those countries that has long been perceived and described in terms of ideological opposites. Known in the USSR and later Russia as the Freedom Island that shed the chains of capitalism, it has long been seen in the West as one big prison ruled with an iron fist. But when you've spent almost half a century documenting the lives of its people, as my guest today has done, you'll find that the reality is different from the idyllic or ideological cliches. What is Cuba really like? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by John Alpert, American journalist and documentary filmmaker. Mr. Alpert, it's good to see you in our studio. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Now, you're here in Russia to promote your documentary called Cuba and the Cameraman, which I think is a very straightforward and a very honest title, because you really show Cuba as you've experienced it over, 45 years.
I worked on that film.
And I think this is very unusual for a Western or American journalist, because most of them believe that you need to cover stories from the position of either neutral observance or often from a position of judgment rather than experience or immersion. Why did you break with that tradition?
I wanted American people to really experience what the Cuban Revolution was like. And it's complicated, and I don't think you can understand this in a 90-second news report. I don't think you can understand it in 20 90-second news reports. I spent 45 years following three families and Fidel Castro. When you watch the revolution and you watch these people age, and you learn a lot about Cuba.
And I think it is also very obvious in your film that this kind of emotional involvement that you develop with your characters also allowed you not only gain trust, but actually gain unprecedented access to some of them, including Fidel Castro. You go the extra mile to show him as a human being rather than, you know, a historical figure. The way you show him, is that really how you remembered him?
That's the way I remember him. Fidel trusted me. I don't know whether he considered me to be a friend. He took a risk allowing my camera into places that it had never been before, into his bedroom, into his kitchen. taking his shirt off for me.
He's not wearing the bulletproof
vest. It's a Fidel that nobody had ever seen. Even the Cubans had never seen a Fidel like this before.
But I've seen some reviews, especially in the American press, and they were very, very critical, especially...
Those aren't the reviews that I saw. I saw there were about 3 weeks after these like really right-wing people who obviously, I don't think had even seen the film, decided they didn't like it. But up to that particular point, every single review was positive, positive, positive.
Well, but I think the accusation or the claim that some of the review writers made was that you were way too friendly and not critical enough with him. How did you feel about it?
I think that there's some very, very critical moments in this film. The special period in Cuba when the economy collapsed, when the Soviet Union fell, and they withdrew their support of Cuba. The negative impact on the Cuban economy was like an 85% contraction of their economy. No electricity, no transportation, food shortages. And because the people trusted me, the people who were suffering, I filmed things that the Cuban people never filmed and that nobody else has filmed. And so the reviews that I saw understood that. More gratifying was the, and I still get them today, the hundreds and hundreds of emails from all over the world, especially from Cubans.
Well, and because I think you treated them really as a human being rather than, you know, a foreigner coming into their country and passing judgments about how flawed their system really is. And I think this is what many people experience with Western journalists, including in this country, when somebody comes to your house, to your country, as flawed as it may be, and tells you, you know, how flawed you really are.
I tried really hard to be honest, and the most gratification I get is when the Cubans say that when their children ask them, these are pro-Castro and anti-Castro, when their kids say, Mommy, Daddy, what was the revolution like? They're going to take my film out and show them my film.
Now, the Americans like to quote this famous saying by a British historian, Lord Acton, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I'm not sure you would put it in quite those terms, but I think being in power for so long as Fidel has been in power and being hunted for so long, because I think he survived more than or around 600 assassination attempts, that would change your personality. Have you noticed any character changes in him over time?
Well, I think I was the last journalist and the last American to be with Fidel before he died. And he was always very open and friendly with me. I think in terms of his relationship to the United States, he needed a strong defensive posture, because the aggression focused on him was really, really very severe. I think it hurt the revolution. I think that the revolution needed to be more flexible. It needed to be more flexible with the human rights. It needed to be more flexible economically. And Fidel got, to some degree, pushed into an inflexible position that he didn't come out of.
Mm-hmm. You think it was a matter of personality aging, or was that because of the pressure that his country was subjected to?
I think it's both. I think it's very, very important to have a very, very strong feedback loop. Fidel, when he was young, was all over the island. He was playing baseball with everybody. You know, he certainly couldn't do that towards the end. But every country needs to be corrected. My country really needs to be corrected. You know, that's our work. That's the work of us reporters. Some people say we're not patriotic. I would like to say that maybe that's quite a high form of patriotism when you point out the things that are wrong with your country because you want your country to be better.
Well, I agree with you, but I think it also depends on how you say it, because I think sometimes, and that's my personal issue with the American journalism and American or Western criticism in general, is that sometimes critical things are being said to put people or countries down rather than show them deficiencies in their systems. And I heard you say in some of the other interviews that you believe that Cuba was never really given a fair chance to run its social experiment to the fullest. Do you still believe that?
I sure would have liked to have seen that happen. You know, when the revolution began, free healthcare, free school, housing, guaranteed jobs, literacy campaigns that taught everybody how to read. Whoa, you know, we were fighting for these things in the United States at that time, and the fact that they were going on in Cuba was very, very exciting. But there was always such tremendous pressure economically, politically, and militarily against the regime. You know, it would have been, let the Cubans experiment so we don't have to try this. If it doesn't work, we can look down there and, oh, gosh, it didn't work in Cuba. Let's forget about having universal health care. But they never had the chance.
I think the problem with the communist systems in general is that while they're striving for bigger things, they tend to forget about the little comforts of life. And I think you put it well in one of your interviews when you said that it's good to have free education or free healthcare, but it's also nice to have a hot shower in the morning. If Cuba hadn't been pressured so much, if it hadn't been sanctioned so much, do you think they would have figured out how to provide both to their population?
You know, they had internal debates there about the economy and sort of individualism. I don't think they were resolved. I think it's one of the reasons why Che Guevara left the country, because he was in conflict with some of the other people that had more power internally. And the tragedies we'll never know.
Cuba is now in the process of having a peaceful transition of power, and the United States Department of State has already described it in pretty derogatory terms.
What did they say?
They said it wasn't free, it wasn't fair, it was dictatorial in nature. They also believe that this is not really a change of power after all, you know, just a change of a figurehead. But there is no way of knowing what I'm going to ask you at this point of time. I think there's not even a way of making it an educated guess, but I'm going to ask you still, how do you think the relationship between Trump's America and Cuba under this new president is going to develop over the next few years? How do you see it?
I would like to see it continue on the path to normalization that was started in the previous administration. I think that was healthy. Look at the blockade and the animosity for 50, almost 60 years. Did it change the regime in Cuba? No, it was a completely unsuccessful policy. If you got in your car to go see your babushka every day and you turn the key and the car doesn't go anyplace, would you get in that same car every day for 50 years? No, you'd go to the metro. You'd take some other route to this. The United States had you talk about Cuba's inflexibility. We had a really inflexible policy too. It was totally unsuccessful. Caused a lot of suffering on the island.
But the United States can afford to be inflexible when it comes to a little neighbor 90 miles away.
The kowtowing to the retrogressive Miami community that is every day more and more a minority, unfortunately, that's back and forth again. The last administration realized that the majority of Cuban Americans wanted normalization, so they normalized. And when you normalize, you can talk. And I want to tell you from my experience in Cuba, when the United States used sugar instead of a hammer, things changed in Cuba in the way that the United States wanted them. I can't go backwards fast enough in this chair to show you what's going on in Cuba now. It seems that in order to protect election prospects in Florida, there's a little bit of a game that's being played with the very, very, very reactionary Cubans who are disrespected more and more every day by the Cuban community.
I've seen some Western commentators compare this new president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, to Mikhail Gorbachev. And I know that you visited the Soviet Union during its reformist years of glasnost and perestroika, which, as inspiring as they may be now in hindsight, ultimately led to the collapse of not only the system, the Soviet system, but also the collapse of the country. Do you think that's a likely scenario for Cuba if the new president indeed pursues the reform agenda, or if he doesn't?
So that was a question that I was asking myself, and I was very, very curious because of the half a century that I spent in Cuba, because of my love for the Cuban people. I wanted to observe this firsthand, but I didn't want to observe it from the back of the pack. And so I had asked the Cuban government to allow me to come inside as they were making their deliberations, as they were passing the power, and to observe this basically like a fly on his shoulder. And they didn't answer me. I had the choice to be in Cuba or be here in Moscow for some very important things this past week, and I chose to come here to Moscow instead of going to Cuba.
Well, we are very happy to welcome you in this country, but for the time being, we have to take a very short break. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with John Alpert, the American journalist and documentary filmmaker. Mr. Alpert, just before the break, you were saying that you had a choice of either going to Cuba or coming to Moscow, and you chose Moscow. And I know that you have something under the table to show us.
I do have something. I have my props here. Can you see this?
Yeah, and I can see the name of legendary Russian hockey player Vyacheslav Fetisov on this jersey. Why do you have it with you?
Look at this.
And obviously we have your name here as well, but still.
So when I was growing up, I didn't want to be a journalist. I can tell you how I became a journalist, but it was completely accidental. My dream was to be a hockey player. But my reality was that I stunk and I wasn't good enough. And I was always very enthusiastic, but an untalented hockey player. But Slava's my friend. I'm working with Slava on a number of projects. One is the first and last hockey game ever on the North Pole. Can you skate?
Not really.
Well, you've got a year, because next year around this time, it basically, to call attention to the environmental crisis of the North Pole and also the sort of political tensions, the Arctic countries, the Vatican, and there's one more, I can't remember what it is, they're all getting together.
Well, I usually do political journalism, and I think right off the bat, I can say that this is a very unusual experience to have Russians and the Americans doing anything constructive, because from my experience, they only bigger. But it's good that you guys can do something in the current environment.
Yeah, you know, I think so. And you've been to war. And I think that because of our shared experience and because I'm looking in your eyes, I can tell that when you go to war as a reporter, there's something that happens inside you, and it changes you as a person, and it compels you, more or less for the rest of your life, to look for other ways to resolve issues.
You visited a number of war zones, but I assume the one that you remember the most would be your coverage of the first Gulf War, for which you were actually fired from NBC. That was clearly, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were specifically fired because you filmed the civilian death toll inflicted by the Americans. That was clearly an act of censorship, but I think, from my experience at least, censorship in different countries relies on different patterns. Have you figured out how it works in the United States?
You know, it's affected me in different ways. I've had the misfortune of being blacklisted twice. I was blacklisted for public television, not for war coverage, but for a documentary about healthcare, because the documentary pointed the finger at the sort of greedy financial interests that were keeping Americans from getting the best healthcare. That was it for public television. But the sort of interesting thing about the United States is that sometimes a door opens and a door closes, and a door opened at NBC. And I was the only independent reporter to work for any of the commercial networks. I had total editorial control of my reports, which is, I have like more editorial control than anybody here at RT has. I think there were a number of circumstances. General Electric, which is a big, powerful country, a company that has a lot of military industrial interests, bought NBC. And from that moment, the gangplank was out for me.
But I think I may be mistaken, but judging from your previous interviews, I think it was more specific. You went to Iraq, you filmed the footage that you were not supposed to film, you managed to smuggle it back into the United States in your socks. You brought it to the NBC executives, and what did they tell you?
That every time I go to the third world, I make trouble for them, and they're tired of it. But
did they actually look at the footage, Was the problem with your behavior or with the actual material that you
brought? And in fact, the regular news staff was devastated by this, and they had all supported me. They had seen the footage and were proud that somebody from their team had gotten this, despite Saddam's attempts to censor me. You know, we had three babysitters. There were three pages of rules and regulations. We broke every single rule. They tried to kill me on the way out of the country. They put a gun to my head and spent 5 minutes trying to pull the trigger to kill me, and I got the stuff back. And everybody was proud of me.
And what was there? What was on the film?
What was on the film? I mean, basically, the smart bombs were not smart. This was what we were being told in the United States during the war, that this was the first bloodless war in history, the first scientific war in history. And let me tell you, when any country believes that they can make war and not hurt people, they become even more dangerous. And so it was crucial to show these reports to the American people.
Did you actually show it to the American people?
Not when they should have seen it during the war. One of the tragedies of the war, and it's studied in journalism classes. There were a number of hand-wringing retrospectives about the way in which the press had not fulfilled its duty to the country during the war, and they didn't.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is that Americans like to use the examples of the first and second Iraqi campaigns as something that they regret. But I think many of those things have been repeated recently. For example, the United States military has just taken over the city of Raqqa, which ISIS used to claim as its capital. It was taken by a very, very heavy aerial bombardment. Practically no building is left standing in that city. There are independent reports of thousands of corpses rotting under the rubble. And there is still very, very little, if any, coverage on the American networks. Doesn't that suggest that the system that you encountered back then is still in operation these days?
I can't talk about that because I haven't been to Syria. I can't talk about those reports because I don't watch the news. When I spend my whole day doing what I'm doing, I don't know about you, I want to watch a hockey game on TV. I don't think I've watched an American newscast in 20 years. I didn't even watch my own reports, because as soon as I finished one of my own reports, I was on an airplane going to the next war. So I can't comment about that. I thought that the way in which the press was treated during the second Gulf War, because I was embedded for 2 months in Baghdad, was respectful, was honest, and was transparent. And it was the 360-degree difference from the first Gulf War. First Gulf War, the press was treated like a bunch of dogs in the alley.
You've been to numerous war zones, but you decided against going to Syria or, for that matter, to Libya. Why is that? Why didn't you want to go there?
And I make a calculus before I decide to go someplace. I'm happy to take a risk. I'm happy to risk my, I can't say I'm happy, but I will risk my life if I think that the report that I make is going to change something. And that's a sort of sophisticated combinations of things. One, I have to be able to get to where I want to go. I have to be able to operate with some degree of freedom. People's minds have to be flexible enough so that if I come back and I say, listen, this is what I think the truth really is, that they'll listen to me, and I need an outlet. I didn't have any of those conditions. When I stopped working for NBC, I began to do documentaries. And the sort of, let's get on the plane, the bell's ringing over in Syria, I'm going to be the first person to the front, the first person back. In those days, I could beat anyone in the world. I'm sure you're good, but I could beat you. But documentaries is different. And documentaries is a longer, slower, thoughtful process. And there are only so many places that you can show them. And we basically make one documentary every 2 years, every 3 years. In the case of Cuba, it took me 45 years. The conditions, and I felt bad, you know, because in order to take this risk, you have to believe that there's something about the way in which you see the world that is important for other people to know. Otherwise, it's insanity to go to these places, and you have to have that burn inside you. So the first couple of times wars happened without me, you had to tie me to the mast, but I didn't have any place to show it.
You know, you weren't there, but there were a lot of coverage of both the Syrian and Libyan conflict, and it was very much split along the ideological lines, because I could see the reports of my Western colleagues, for example, from Libya. Uh-huh. I was with there on the same square, right, in the same building, working at the, you know, from the same desk, but they would show something totally, totally different. I mean, the reality that the I wouldn't even recognize. And I'm sure they would say the same things about my reports. We are now in the age of propaganda wars, post-truth, post-fact. Do you think you could even adapt to this kind of working environment?
I did pretty good in Egypt. So I was in the square in Egypt for the revolution. It's a pretty good film. It played on HBO. We didn't win the Oscar, but we got on the shortlist for the Oscar Awards. And so made a film from, I don't know if you appreciate like my type of way of doing things. It was a quintessential film in the way in which we do it. Very well received. So the opportunities still do exist. And, you know, it's also our responsibilities as reporters to try and be as honest as possible, to not have an agenda when there's lots of forces pulling us this way and pulling us that way.
It's not about having an agenda. I think, from what I see at least, I think many Western reporters, they come to Cuba or they come to Syria with the preconceived notion of what that country is. And they do their reports from the balconies of the hotels.
We call them balcony buzzards.
Well, whatever. I mean, that means close, that things, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
And so, you know, listen, the first report I ever did for NBC was the first time I'd ever been in a war zone. I was up in Lang Son, Vietnam. The Chinese were on the hills shooting at anything that moved. And I, like a moron, I'm walking down the street there with my Vietnamese buddies. And so you know what I did? Everybody else runs for cover. I grab the microphone and I do a stand-up, because that's all I'd ever seen a reporter
does. Well, that means you have true reporter's instinct.
And so I said, I'm telling them what was obvious. I'm here in Lang Son, that people are shooting at me, and my name is John Alpert, and I'm working for NBC News. I looked at that and I said, you know what? That's the last stand-up I'm ever. I never did another one. I was so ashamed of myself, because all I was doing was copycatting. You know, they all wear the same clothes. They wear the trench coats in the winter. They wear the safari suits. And they walk around with briefcases. I'm going, well, what the heck is in their briefcases? You know what it is? It's makeup. And they spend the whole day waiting for the sun to get into the right position. They got somebody standing there with the tray to reflect. And they're on the balcony.
Well, I think...
So shame on them. And hero awards to people who go do something different. And it's not just American reporters. I've seen Russian reporters, I've seen people like this all over the world,
well,
and I've seen good reporters from every single country who will get dirty and will try to understand what the people are doing.
Well, I agree with you definitely on that. I guess we have only a minute left, and I want to ask you perhaps a philosophical question, but still, I think much of the global tensions are still centered around those concepts of freedom, democracy, tyranny, development, human flourishing. And what always strikes me is how differently they are interpreted in different countries. What freedom means to an American is very different from what freedom means to a Cuban or to a Syrian or even to a Russian, for that matter. Do you think those differences are genuine? Do you think we will ever be able to arrive at the, you know, some common understanding of what freedom really is?
I think it's always good to have differences. But we can't let those differences separate us. And what we need to do is, even though we might look at the world differently, we need to walk through the world holding hands and talk to each other about our differences like we're doing here today.
Well, be you know, mindful of being branded as a Kremlin sympathizer, because I think in this day and age, even appearing on this network may get you in trouble.
Okay, but anybody who knows me knows that I've always been my own person, and people have respected me for that, and that's why they invite me to come back time and time again, and that's why this project about the first and last hockey game at the North Pole, which has been endorsed by the United Nations, that's the other...
I certainly...
Let's do it together, and I'll teach you how to skate. You won't learn how to skate well, but I'll teach you.
Well, I will definitely try my best. But in any case, I hope that we can discuss your next project, let's say in a year's time, in this very studio. Thank you for being here today. I invite our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.